From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
It's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we're rejoicing and glad to be joined by Bishop William Wiegand, the Bishop Emeritus of the Diocese of Sacramento. Bishop, good day to you.
Same to you, Bob. Thank you very much, and hello to all of our listeners. It's a holy, blessed time, and Christmas is quite near now.
Boy, it really is. We're right down to the last Sunday of Advent, huh?
Coming up, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So it's almost time for the when you were bishop, it seems to me I can't imagine the schedule. Oh, you're still an active bishop, but the schedule you would keep at Christmas time.
Yes, at Christmas and all times.
At all times. I forgot the other 364 days.
Yes, it's. I've stepped down 13 years ago, the end of November, and it's amazing how life has gotten slower, I guess I want to say, and how life has gotten better because it's slower. So I look back at the rush of things and the multitasking spiritual leader, one in charge also of the temporalities of the diocese and the civic obligations and so forth. So even I kind of look back and wonder how in the world did I do it?
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't want to do it again. It's kind of life should be slower.
Yes, indeed. Well, at Christmas time, you know, I know the Holy Father gave up midnight mass. I think it was Pope Benedict that gave up midnight mass. He finally said it's just too late. We're going to do midnight mass at 10 p.m.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He got elderly, and Pope Francis is too, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
Plus, most people kind of prefer an earlier midnight mass, I think.
Well, I would think. I know when my children were very young, they were fascinated by the concept of midnight mass, just like they were long past their bedtime. And we would always tell them, next year we'll go to midnight mass. You know, I think finally when they were teenagers, we took them to midnight mass.
Well, I remember as a kid myself, and we went to midnight mass.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the ordinary routine, and it was so special. Then we'd come home and have kind of an early, a 2 a.m. breakfast or something.
Right.
It was... then crashed, I guess, the day. So it was special because it was midnight, but it fouled up our routines.
For sure. But yeah, you're right, and I found that with our own kids that it was so special that they were wide awake when the time we finally took them and thrilled to be there. You know, and the sort of the majesty of the midnight mass, there's just something very special about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's still true. So at our cathedral, of course, we still have midnight mass.
Right.
And it's still a big mass. I assume it will be again this year in spite of COVID concerns. But there are many other masses. I mean, I have the Spanish Midnight Mass at our Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament at 9 p.m.
Right.
And that's late enough for me.
Right.
But it's because you can't have two masses at midnight, so one goes earlier. But there are a couple of Christmas Eve masses also.
Right.
And in that sense, we have fewer masses on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the Christmas or the Sunday evening masses. They fall out because of the Christmas Eve masses. But a lot of people get out, not as big as Easter, but certainly a very big attendance.
Yeah, that used to be the the trick question we would ask our parish priest when we were growing up after catechism class on Saturday mornings. Which day was bigger, Christmas or Easter?
Yeah, and I suppose it varies a bit depending on a place and culture, but mm-hmm. in my experience, it's always been Easter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just from mass attendance, I think it's easily Easter, for a variety of reasons. But Easter obviously is ultimately what it's all about.
Yeah. Now midnight Christmas midnight mass, certainly at the cathedral, but typically in parishes also,
mm-hmm.
Draws. Good church-going Catholics and so forth, but it also draws others.
Yes, it does.
There's something about it. So less than fully active Catholics, but also non-Catholics. Other churches typically don't have the midnight mass, and so you've got an array of people,
mm-hmm.
but it's special for all of them in different ways.
Right.
So I
can imagine a midnight mass might have led to a more than a handful of conversions too.
Oh, I would think so. Often conversions start with people just wander into
mm-hmm.
a Catholic church.
Right.
Our cathedral is special that way because it's so beautiful. And
sure.
And people wander in just to say a prayer or just to sit in silence before the majesty of whatever their notion of God. And
mm-hmm.
But that starts something.
Mm-hmm.
And a second step might be actually attending the midnight mass then that
right.
they see scheduled. And so God uses lots of things to attract us. And, of course, that's what he's trying to do during Advent for all of us at all levels of faith, to get back to a little better level of faithfulness in our prayers and in our relationships. Be more thoughtful, be more aware of others, touch base with others. There's lots of things in the Christmas season that are not simply being in church, but are church-related
mm-hmm.
or faith-related that we've been inspired again to be more thoughtful,
right.
to get back in touch with loved ones, with forgotten ones, to make amends, get back in touch to somebody you're alienated with, and it all flows out of the notion of divine love, God himself coming to us in our brokenness, so we ought to imitate him and come to others, open our lives to others, and that includes, of course, the homeless, the hungry. There's just lots of dimensions of the Christmas mystery, and we have to prepare for it. That's what Advent is, and we don't change gears very easily or very quickly. It takes us four Sundays.
That's right. Yeah, it is interesting that there really is, and I think we've all noticed it in our lives, and hopefully in ourselves, the ill-defined Christmas spirit. You know, which obviously is our Christian calling. We should be that, 365 days of the year. But there is a greater generosity, not just financial or gift-giving, but just a generosity of spirit toward our fellow man during the Christmas season.
Yes. And that got stressed a little bit during our true COVID years, I think, or got expressed in more clumsily, and we didn't have, at least last year, hopefully this year is better, we didn't quite have the contact with others in the same way that we did in normal years.
Right.
And we missed that, which probably is one of the kind of the Christmas things that was a blessing, one of the blessings that has and is still flowing out of the COVID.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact we need people, and others need people, and others need us, and we miss contact with people. We miss being able to hug, to be close, to snuggle up, COVID has gotten in the way of that. Still is to some extent, but
right.
At least we see one another more now, even if we still have to distance a bit and in public, there was a put on a mask. But because we have to do it, it's such a burden, and it's so awful to talk to somebody, especially a loved one,
right,
with a mask on. I mean, it's an outrage. it's just you're not yourself.
It's contrary to our nature, for sure.
It's totally contrary. So the missing of it maybe is good for us, that we treasure it again and see how those little things are far more important than spending a big money on one another. It's just
right.
It's just being able to smile at one another and to talk and to chat and to be with one another. And again, that's Christmas in a way. I mean, God came out of nowhere to be with us, you might say. He found us in the little town of Bethlehem and in a smelly manger. So wherever we are, God came. God got close to us. That's the whole notion, and that we need to find one another and get back to loving one another and being with one another. So all of that flows out of Christmas, and the lack of some of that because of COVID. Perhaps has brought it back to us about how precious it is. We've rediscovered some humble things. In some ways, we've rediscovered family.
Yes.
Because we've kind of lost it, and friendship, because we kind of lost it. So those are blessings. It's ongoing because COVID isn't over yet, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So we have to find ways of touching base with one another, I think we're doing that better than a year ago.
Getting
around the strictures. We're being creative, I think.
Yeah, I've found that we you know, we got vaccinated and we are careful and we wear a mask when we're supposed to. And but we've kind of made that decision that we're not going to take unreasonable risks or do something stupid or defiant. But on the same page that we do cherish all those things you just mentioned, and we did it at Thanksgiving. You know, we kept it small, but by golly, we lowered our masks between bites of turkey. You know, and right. Had family.
Right, and I think most people had a much better and more normal Thanksgiving mm-hmm. this year than a year ago for the very same reason. And hopefully Christmas will be the same. But again, we still do have to be careful. You're absolutely right.
It's so, you know, this new variant, which we don't know a lot about, but apparently spreads rapidly and perhaps maybe not as virulent, but spreads much more rapidly. And of course, they don't seem to have the data yet on people that are already at risk, already with compromised health conditions. If it's going to be as devastating to them as the Delta was or the original, but it's scary. But at the same token, I think it makes us turn even more to God and say, God, you're in control. We aren't. Help us weather this.
Well, it certainly does in some cases, and certainly people of faith, mm-hmm. And even people who've gotten a bit lax or forgetful, cold in their faith. When it comes to tough times, they remember there's a God and that they're not God.
Yes.
And that they need God. So I suppose that, again, if you want to put words on a blessing out of the time of COVID, it's we've been forced to remember that we're often very helpless, humans. We get so used to the technological age that we can do almost anything and distance and space. I mean, we can contact people and we can go to outer space and we can fix anything and everything,
mm-hmm.
but this we can't fix. And the big tragedies in life, even in modern times, often are referred to as acts of God.
Right, right.
You know, the earthquake, the tornado, the hurricane, or the
mm-hmm.
Whatever acts of God. Well, they're not acts of God; they're acts of nature. But
right.
They're acts that we can't control, and God permits them. God created the universe, and this part of the universe, our star, and our planetary system, our Milky Way, but it's all going to burn out one day, like other stars. And but it's very long term, and we get used to living in sync with it, and until it kind of rocks the boat,
mm-hmm.
the tectonic plates. Hit one another or something, and there's an upheaval. So, those notions are part and parcel of the scriptures of Advent. I've been quite aware of it during these true COVID years. The Old Testament readings often refer to the, quote, acts of God. Almost everything
mm-hmm.
in simpler times were acts of God because they couldn't control them.
Right.
And so they were often, and that's why they referred to things they couldn't control. Somehow God is angry with us.
Right.
Which must mean that we've been sinful, and of course they were, and we are, humans are. So we better mend our ways. We better get back to saying our prayers and being kind to others and not walking all over others and so get back to the commandments, including the big two, love God, love others, love one another, and because the lack of control, they got invaded by a neighboring tribe or something, and so they and got defeated. So their faith conclusion was, well, we're sinful. God is unhappy with us. Well, pretty quickly, then a prophet would show him and say, well, no, God isn't unhappy with you. God loves you. Okay, so, but then they get careless until some other unforeseen thing happens, and it's a wake up call again. I guess that means we should get back to God. In modern times, again, the things we don't control come less frequently. Because a lot of our technology and our inventiveness and so forth, and so in the rhythms of human life, we don't get shaken up quite as often. That causes us to come back and remember that there's a God and we need God but COVID is the time, probably not since the great flu time of 1917. I mean, this is something that is so out of control. But in a way, we'll get used to it if it's ongoing. We don't control the flu year by year either.
Right.
And all kinds of people die of the flu.
Sure.
As the last straw often, because of other, what today they're calling comorbidities.
Right, yeah. Don't you love that term? Yeah.
And obesity or diabetes or other complications. And the flu comes along and in earlier times, old sickly people looked on flu or pneumonia as a friend, because it gets us to the other world.
Right.
It gets us to a better life because life has become so burdensome. So we don't look at anymore as a friend that's the ticket to the next life and the fullness of life in our society. But we want to go there, so something has to be the reason for our leaving this world and going to God, going back to God, the fullness of life. For many, it's COVID, and yet it's such a sad thing. That's another Advent, early Advent theme of going to God and judgment, that's our calling. We're destined, and so prepare for that too. We call it prepare for death. Be ready for death. Live a good life.
Right.
Do the best you can. Accept your pains, your aches and pains as part of the suffering of Jesus offered up for others and for the souls in purgatory, and try to be kind and thankful and helpful, and all of that is a way to get ready, not simply for Christmas, but for death, for going to God, for God coming to us to take us to his loving embrace.
And Jesus says, we won't know. He'll come like the thief in the night.
Again, the early Advent scriptures, even the images of the end of the world, in a sense, the final coming of Christ, and so forth. They're often taken as fearsome things. The sky is falling. The earth is ending, it's all burning up or whatever. Well, for people of faith, those things were in the early ages were basically not things to fear. Those were things, the signs that that the next life is real and is coming.
Yeah, they were as an affirmation.
As an affirmation. The best time is coming close now. The end of this world, so as to start the beginning of the next life. That's joyful. That's happy.
Yes. Yeah. And every generation seemed to think that they were. Go ahead.
I was going to say the signs of it became kind of fearful, and it's not to be fearful. It's to be happy.
Right.
We're going to be fine. This world has to end for the next one to begin.
Right. Yeah. The second coming is part of our belief. And now I sense, like you say, they say in the early times after Christ, that virtually every generation believed they were the ones. It was going to happen during their lifetimes. And now it seems that we put it more into almost a mythical category, as opposed to, hey, it could happen tomorrow.
That's for all kinds of reasons, I think. In part because we know scientifically, the world, the universe, is huge. And the forces, whatever the beginning that God, the Big Bang, and so forth. It's the universe, and now they talk about the universes in the plural. Mm-hmm. It's expanding more and more. It's getting bigger and bigger, which means the divine power behind it is more awesome than we realized.
Right.
But as it gets bigger and bigger, the earlier stages of us burn out. Stars and the equivalent of Milky Ways that have already gone their way and have become a black hole or something in the universe. So the existence of the universe seems eternal. I mean, it's so we forget about it. Yes, it's certainly going to end for each one of us at our death, and that's for some of us is got to be fairly close now. I'm 84 and with comorbidities, for our world as we know it, it could come any time.
Sure.
And Advent reminds us of those endings, but those beginnings and the coming of the Lord at each one of those new. And that means at midnight Mass or Christmas Day Mass in a very special way. A new coming of the Lord, and we even envision him as the infant Savior coming to us in grace with his love and peace, the Prince of Peace, because we need that. Boy, we need peace in a personal and in families and in relationships and patience with this COVID and so forth. But he does come if we open our hearts and if we're ready, if we see the need and again, an Advent quote, the scripture right out of Isaiah, those who are thirsty, come to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are hungry, come. And without paying, it's free. Just come.
It's free. Yeah. Isn't that remarkable? It's free.
Yeah. And more wonderful than the heart could imagine. So,
yeah,
and many people do. I think there's a God touches people in unknown ways and surprising ways that aren't necessarily even going to church. Christmas time is a blessed time for most people, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Bishop Wiegand, when you were growing up in a small town in the Idaho Panhandle, did you have special family traditions at Christmas?
Yes. As I mentioned, certainly midnight mass,
right.
And that certainly meant getting to confession before Christmas. But the traditions of getting ready for that, which included the Christmas tree, and we, in many of the years, went out and found our own Christmas tree out to the woods, and
right.
That made it even more special. We always got one that was too big. We had to cut half of it off.
Right.
It didn't look that big in the forest.
Right. Yeah, it's one of the smaller trees in the forest.
Yeah. And, but as I said, after midnight mass and so forth, we generally had a breakfast of some kind. And in early years, we didn't open the presents. There was discipline because we were young. We had to go to bed and opening. But as we got older, the after midnight mass got longer. We stayed up. We had breakfast. We opened presents and then went to bed kind of late and slept in.
Sure.
Typically, we had a big earlier mid-afternoon, a big meal of some kind. It was special. It could be a turkey again or a ham, or now and then we'd have a goose, the Christmas goose,
sure.
Or if not at Christmas, at New Year's. But often we got together with one of the aunts and uncles and their kids, or with some cousins, and the closest ones I had, again, on my mother's side, also in the Panhandle, but in Wallace, or on my dad's side in Spokane. So we had one or other of them to our place, or we went there often Christmas afternoon, if the weather permitted. So a little bit broader, other family members were further away. So that was about the extent of it. And very often we had the pastor over as part of that if we were at Christmas Mass. My dad was always good at that, never took for granted that the pastor, the father, so-and-so would be invited for Christmas dinner. So he said, we better check. And often he wasn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Often he said yes to our invitation.
Everybody assumed he had some place to go, and he didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, and Wallace, that's another very interesting town in the Panhandle, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Yes. Quite a history.
Going back to the big fire, was it 1910, was it?
Right.
The big fire, the in the Northwest, the drought and the fire. And,
right.
And Wallace was one of the towns that got burned out. And,
right.
And when the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, is brand new and learning how to put out fires, they learned a lot that year.
Oh, they did. I happened to be at Priest Lake in the late 60s when they had the Sundance Fire, and they started knocking on cabin doors, and I was in my early 20s, and they said, have you ever fought a fire before? I said, no, and they said, you have boots? And I said, no, and they said, we'll give you some boots, and off we went, those of us who couldn't fight fires, they put us in the kitchen. But they needed all hands on deck. They didn't care if you're from California or where you were from. And some people referred to that 1910 fire and then the Freeman Lake fire in about 1931.
Yeah, those were. Yeah, by the way, St. Mary's and Wallace, in between the two, 1910, way up the St. Joe River is Avery.
Mm-hmm.
And Avery's on the other side of the mountain from Wallace, and so it was going to get burned too. And the battalion of I guess it was what we call it today, the National Guard.
So, right.
The battalion or the unit of the National Guard that got sent to try to save Avery was a black group.
Hmm.
And people in the Panhandle, I had never seen a black person, I guess. And they were skeptical and hostile, but that town got saved. And little town, thereafter, they were so appreciative to the black unit of the National Guard that saved their town.
Wow.
Interesting.
Sometimes it takes something like that to break down prejudice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Very interesting, yeah. So how often in St. Mary's would you see, the diocese is all the state, right? How often would you see the bishop?
Not very often. at confirmation time,
right.
Big time, we saw him in St. Mary's. Let's see, it would have been about 54, I guess,
mm-hmm.
when he came up to dedicate the new church,
mm-hmm.
the St. Mary of the Assumption Church. And so that would have been an unusual occasion, of course. But no, we didn't see... getting around the state of Idaho was not that easy.
And
as I got older and was in the seminary, I would see him more often, of course, because I would have to check in Boise, or
mm-hmm.
or he would visit us at the seminary also when I was in school. And
where was the seminary for the Diocese of Boise?
Well, for minor seminary, so high school and first 2 years of college,
mm-hmm.
typically was always Mount Angel Seminary.
Oh, in Oregon, yeah.
In Oregon, and then it was the custom of the bishop to switch for major seminaries to Seattle.
Oh, okay.
Or Kenmore on the north,
mm-hmm.
the northwest. What was it, north? I guess it's northwest quarter,
right?
Of Lake Washington,
right?
So for the second half of college, which was the emphasis on philosophy
mm-hmm.
stuff, and then all of divinity or theological studies, the 4 years of postgraduate.
Give me five.
So it was six and six.
Wow. And where was your first assignment in the Diocese of Boise after ordination?
Lewiston.
Oh, wow. That's a nice town.
Nice town and fairly close. I think the bishop was trying to be a little thoughtful, keeping me a bit in the north where I felt comfortable. So at the time, there were two parishes in the Jesuit parish in the old part of town, and the newer part of town was Our Lady of Lourdes. On the avenue going up to the upper part of what was called the Orchards, the upper part of Lewiston, was great land, was all orchards at one time and started to be populated, and today there's not much of anything left to the orchards. It's all part of Lewiston, and the one citywide parish is now up in the orchards.
Oh, wow.
For the whole city of Lewiston. But anyway, I was there only 1 year at Our Lady of Lourdes as the associate pastor, what we call the parochial vicar today. And I was able to get home St. Mary's from time to time during that time. My father had died. In the meantime, of course, my mother was alone, so it was a blessing for her if I could get home now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say it was a couple of hours trip or two and a half, I forget.
Yeah.
But anyway, after 1 year, I was assigned to Boise through the bishop's office. To help out the longtime chancellor, who was the twin brother of my pastor. My pastor was Father Hughes. His brother was Nick Hughes. And so I basically took his place at the bishop's office. He became pastor of the cathedral, or the person in charge under the bishop. So, he helped me. He kind of broke me in, basically. And I was there 4 years, basically, at the bishop's office, helping out in different parishes and at the high school.
Right.
Doing different things as part-time. And after which I went to South America for 10 years.
Wow.
Mission parish in Cali, Colombia.
Right. Was the high school Bishop Kelly then, or is that a more recent?
Well, it was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
It had just been established by the new bishop, Bishop Celestia Trinan.
Mm-hmm.
Who had been who came to the diocese just 1 year before I was ordained, and by the way, I was the first one he ordained. So a year after, actually less than a year after he arrived, he often commented that he thought he did a good job at my ordination because I was the first one he ordained, and he thought I remained a good priest. And became a bishop. He said, "Wow, I did a pretty good job."
Good. How did Cali, Colombia come about?
Pope John the 23rd was responsible, actually.
Hmm.
He had a concern for Latin America at the time, had a shortage of clergy, and the for different reasons. He had a concern. His prior work in diplomatic service and so forth made him quite aware of the needs in Latin America. So anyway, as Pope, he basically asked the U.S. bishops to think about sending 10% of their clergy to Latin America.
Wow.
10%. And so a lot of dioceses got into the act. One of the first was Portland.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the very first, many would say the very first priest who went to Latin America under that call was a priest of Portland by the a big strapping a priest called Father Kennard.
Hmm.
With a K, Kennard.
Right.
It was Father Kennard who, in Peru, basically hit up with the nuncio at the time to Peru, and he said, "Do you suppose you could get somebody like Cardinal Cushing involved
mm-hmm.
to send some clergy to Latin America?" So it was Father Kennard from Portland, Oregon, who went to Boston.
Wow.
To talk to the Cardinal Cushing mm-hmm. and tell him about the needs in Latin America. And anyway, that ignited the imagination of Cardinal Cushing, and by golly, he established, with the help of Father Kennard from Portland, Oregon. Isn't that one coast to the other
coast? That is amazing.
Amazing. And Father Kennard basically wrote the statutes and kind of for the establishing of the St. James Society
mm-hmm.
of diocesan priests from Boston and elsewhere who would volunteer to go and spend a few years. I think it was, again, the statute set up by a three-year terms, mm-hmm. renewable. To go to Latin America, Peru, Bolivia, and wherever. Cardinal Cushing really gave it a push, and a lot of priests. There was, if anything, excess priests, mm-hmm. plenty of priests in Boston, over the next few years signed up. But many priests from elsewhere joined, including from the Northwest and from the West, under the auspices, basically, of the organized group called mm-hmm. the St. James Society, mm-hmm. established in Boston. Other dioceses of the Northwest followed suit, including Spokane and Helena,
mm-hmm.
And Boise.
Mm-hmm.
So several dioceses of Spokane, Helena, and two or three other dioceses, including Oklahoma City.
Oh, wow.
And Tulsa, down in that area,
mm-hmm.
somehow ended up in the highlands of Guatemala,
mm-hmm.
where Helen and Spokane, and Boise ended up in Cali, Colombia. Bishop Trinan sent Father Nick Walsh down, my vocation director, down to study the, and we already had Benedictine sisters in Colombia,
mm-hmm.
At Bogota. So he said, "Well, we have Idaho's already downloaded. Let's look at Colombia." And he visited different areas and reached an agreement with the Archbishop of Cali, Colombia. So in May of 1957, he and Father and a second priest went, but he went first. And a year later, I joined them. So in May of 1968.
Wow.
And again, for 3 years, the same kind of framework as the St. James Society we had, but renewable. I stayed 3 terms plus.
Wow.
10 years. And the idea was to work especially with the poor. Don't come down like Spanish conquistadores.
Right.
And be humble and take a humble poor parish. So ours was on the outskirts of the city of Cali, where people had come from the hinterlands, from the mountains and from the rural areas, partly because of the allure of cities and jobs and education, but also because of conflict, warfare, basically, in parts of the country. People flocking to the outskirts of the cities and squatting, so squatters on properties, public and private, which the city eventually had to purchase, basically, and organize into blocks and with streets and public services. So even by the time I got there, part of the parish had electricity, part of it didn't. Part of the parish had running water and sewer systems, and part didn't. And a lot of that got developed fairly quickly, actually, during the 10 years that I was there. And today it's a middle-class area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... 50 years later, it's gone up the socioeconomic, and poor areas are out still further.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But anyway, that was Pope John calling on the U.S. bishops to think about. Not all did, not all could. Pope Paul VI repeated that request.
Mm-hmm.
And Pope John Paul II affirmed it in a way, but then over time, part of our job, of course, was to promote vocations among the poor,
right,
and the lower income peoples, which we did. I worked very diligently in that, and closely with the archdiocese and. We had many kids from our parish who needed financial help, obviously, to go to the seminary and to study. So over time, the vocations became abundant, and help from outside wasn't needed. In fact, many of those countries now send missionaries
right.
to the U.S.
Right.
and elsewhere because now we need them. So,
right.
But that the church has always kind of been that way, actually.
Right.
So it was nothing I had planned on when I went to the seminary that I would ever end up in South America, but what a blessing it was, and what an experience.
Oh, I can imagine.
That helped prepare me, frankly, to be a bishop.
Mm-hmm.
That experience in other some other country and culture and language and the different ministry needs of people and so forth just broadened my horizons amazingly.
Well, Bishop, I can't believe we are out of time. we have exhausted our allotted time here, and I'm just fascinated. I want to pursue this because I know then shortly after you were named as the Bishop of Salt Lake City, and then eventually came here to, we were blessed to have you come here to Sacramento, and we can thank you for many, many, many things, including what you mentioned earlier, how beautiful our cathedral is. And so I'd like to tell you how much we all appreciate everything you have done and continue to do, and hope you have a blessed and merry and holy Christmas. And I hope we can see you again in person without our masks even sometime in the new year.
Yeah, well, thanks, Bob, and Merry Christmas to all of our listeners. And I, by the way, I'm happy to have this occasion to chat, because a lot of people out there think I'm dead. and I'm not. I'm still around. I'm old and creaky and trying not to be cranky, but I'm doing real well. So God bless everyone out there.
Thank you so much, Bishop. God bless you, too, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too. That's Bishop William Wiegand, and what a joy and a treasure he is and has always been here in the Diocese of Sacramento. He served a long time in Salt Lake City when he was, and, you know, when he retired here in Sacramento, even though he still does, is very active, but helping out in a lot of ways. When he retired, they had a big, big dinner for him. And a lot of people came out from Salt Lake City, including representatives of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, came out because they were so fond of him. So God bless Bishop Wiegand, and thanks for all he does. And I saw him at the dinner of the Bishop Gallegos Maternity Home dinner in September, and he does. He looks very, very good, very, very healthy, and hale and hearty, as they say. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town, and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento, who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission, and also to support the diocese, and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. So the easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
Inside of me, I feel your spirit is moving. You're on here.